Well, the next three classes particularly, we're going to concern ourselves with the sort of enormous transformation that happened really in the 60s and leading into the 70s. And so much of what we're going to talk about, we're not going to be playing very much music because a lot of the pieces in those days tended to be much more socially oriented than musically oriented. Morty Feldman said in his own ironic way, once I remember, he said, he thought that the reason American art was born in the early 1950s, he thought, was because of President Eisenhower. And when I asked him why President Eisenhower was responsible for this, he said, well, it was the first time in recent American history where any president left us alone long enough so we could actually think about art and not think about social issues. And it was true. In the early 50s, for the first time, America had sort of settled. If you listen to the majority of music written in the 30s, it was the midst of a huge depression, and the music tends to be obviously quite conservative. The social issues were enormous. Imagine writing music during World War II. Again, the social issues were so enormous that it inhibited the kind of free thinking that an artist would have. But by 1952, America had settled into a really relatively stable culture economically, and for the first time, there were no extreme pressing social issues that sort of inhibited the free thinking of the artist. America was designing itself, as I commented in earlier classes, to be a perfect culture. There was great optimism that now that everything bad was over, America was going to be perfect. And for America to be perfect, it was necessary to, in essence, limit a lot of the sort of extreme things that could happen so society could be stable. And the limits of the 50s, as I pointed out earlier, were enormous. I think an extremely good example of this is that article you read by Aaron Copland, where he was before the House on Un-American Activities Committee for communism, which was a rather absurd stance. And then when you listen to the recording of the Lincoln portrait and put those two things together, and you realize that the U.S. government was trying to restrict people from hearing the Lincoln portrait, you can see how far it was going. Also, many authors were in question. James Joyce was banned in many places. Henry Miller was not allowed at that stage in most places. And there was a great deal of sort of repression of emotion in a certain way. Just to show you the transformation, I mentioned this statistic before, but let's go over 30 years now. In 1959, 90% of the people in America were against premarital sex. At the end of the 1960s, 81% of males were in favor of it, and 41% of females were in favor of it. By 1990, the most recent survey taken, 90% of men were in favor of it, 81% of women were in favor of it. So you can see how it went from, in 30 years, 90% of the people against it to 90% of the people for it is an enormous transformation. Also, something that was starting to be very problematic in the 50s was the whole civil rights idea, because in 1954, when the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional to segregate schools, the movement was starting to get much more extreme. And as you recall, remember in 1957 in Arkansas, the governor actually sent in the National Guard to prevent integration of the schools. And as I mentioned before, President Eisenhower actually had to send in troops to stop this, the 101st Airborne. And then, as I mentioned before, in 1958, governors of two states, Arkansas and Virginia, chose, rather than integrate the schools, they would actually close the entire public school system so the private schools could maintain their whiteness. Now, the other thing that was sort of ironic about the 50s is it sort of prepared the whole drug revolution, which was going to happen in the 60s, because the 50s sort of cured any possible thing with drugs. I was thinking the other day how ironic it was when my sister was 15 in 1955, she was a little worried about being overweight. So she went to the doctor and he prescribed diet pills. Now, in those days, diet pills were strong amphetamines, which are now very illegal. Amphetamines, by the way, were invented by the Nazis during World War II to help the soldiers fight better and get more involved with the war. So my sister was taking these heavy amphetamines so she wouldn't gain weight, and she was very nervous, of course, so he gave her very strong tranquilizers so she wouldn't be too nervous. And, of course, then she couldn't sleep at night, so he gave her very strong sleeping pills. So here's this 15-year-old girl taking, first thing in the morning, amphetamine with tranquilizers and sleeping pills to go to sleep. And this was common, and he gave her an unlimited prescription. She didn't even have to go back to him. She just called the pharmacy whenever she wanted this. This was also the period of an amazing thing that American society invented at that stage called the frontal lobotomy. I imagine most of you have heard of that. if someone was sort of out of control or really out of control, they had a certain brain operation which they could perform on the person, which was irrevocable, that left them completely like a vegetable for the rest of their life. They wouldn't cause any more trouble. If you want to see a great movie about that sometime, see Suddenly Last Summer, Tennessee Williams plays. It's all about this woman who really knows too much, so they're secretly trying to get her to have a frontal lobotomy so she won't tell what she knows. So, as the I Ching said when I asked it about this class, if a man should go too far in imposing limitations on others, they would rebel. Therefore, it is necessary to set limits even upon the limitations. As I've mentioned before, also, there was a kind of extreme counterculture forming in the 50s. Regressing just for a second, I think you can look at history as sort of a reflection on current metaphors. And I talked about in the 19th century how the metaphor that started to overwhelm society was evolution, the whole Darwinian thing. About this, certainly around the same time that the whole idea of evolution was starting, was the first time composers stopped putting repeats in their music anymore. Mozart used repeats. You could go back clearly because Mozart was in the metaphor of Newtonian physics. Everything is neat, everything can be explained, everything is in order, and therefore repetition is certainly one part of the order. But in the 20th century, we came into a new metaphor, and the new metaphor was relativity. And it's a very strong metaphor. I think this metaphor is now going through transformation, and I'm not sure what the new metaphor is. We'll spend the last two classes sort of speculating on perhaps where that metaphor is going. And that metaphor really stopped in the 60s. In the 50s, it was a very strong metaphor, and the extremeness of the metaphor of relativity was what we used to call then existentialism. Everything is isolated, everything... Nothing is with meaning, and everything is individualized. You can certainly see this in the music of Cage and Babbitt, where they take apart all of the aspects of music that were always used to project kind of phrases and glue them back together completely independently. You can see this in art forms, which we'll talk about later, things like happenings and performance art and all of those come out of this metaphor of existentialism, which is really an extreme of relativity. Well, this existential movement led to the Beat Generation, as it was called, and the Beatniks. It led to the new kind of poetry of people like Ginsberg, the new kind of novel of people like Kerouac, and as I said before, the music of people like John Cage. And the other thing that was starting to happen at this stage with this beginning of a counterculture was something that the 50s really didn't like, and that was the breaking of the dress code. It was very important in the 50s for people to dress properly. We had strong dress codes when I was in school. Even when I was in college, I went in 1964 at Yale, and it was all male then, no women at all. Again, a big transformation that's happened. We had to wear a coat and tie to every single meal, even breakfast at 7 in the morning. You didn't have, that was the only part of the dress code. It was absolutely absurd, but you had to do that. I worked in the dining hall the first year for work study, and we had an Olympic gold medalist swimmer in the dormitory, and he would come usually to the dining hall in his swim shorts and a coat and tie. But as long as he had his coat and tie on, no one would say anything. It's just that you had to conform in that way. Well, the Beatniks didn't conform that way. The Beatniks started having, remember, if you watched old TV shows, they had little goatees, and they started to have longer hair, and they started wearing blue jeans rather than nice slacks, and this whole kind of transformation was happening. Well, by the end of the 60s, the counterculture was absolutely enormous. By the end of the 60s, 3.5 million people in this country were living in communes. That's a lot of people. In 1967, there were 100,000 teenagers that left their families and their schools and moved to San Francisco. 100,000 kids, all teenagers. That's pretty amazing, too. Now, really, this whole movement, the counterculture, developed in the colleges more than anywhere else. And it originated really more than anything else in the civil rights movement. Because the civil rights movement showed in the late 50s that it was possible that if you actually took an active stance, you could change things. Now, in the 60s, one of the things that created the counterculture so strongly in the schools was the Vietnam War. Because if you went to college in 1965, you weren't eligible to be drafted. And if you didn't go to college, the chances were pretty good you would get drafted. So all these kids are moving into colleges. Now, one of the things that most strongly started this whole movement, again, as I say, was the Civil Rights Movement, and it was an organization called SNCC, S-N-C-C, Students Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And it started as a civil rights black movement, and it was extremely well organized. And their whole purpose was essentially in an orderly and calculated way to integrate, especially, first of all, the South. So they knew, it was an amazing movement. They were so determined. They knew they were going to be beaten badly in riots, and they actually practiced in classes that they had getting beaten, so they had nowhere to, what parts of their head to cover, what were more vulnerable. So their first stance was, let's integrate Mississippi by getting all the blacks to vote. They tried very hard to do that, but it was a failure. They only got 5% of the black population out. So they decided what they would do was bring the whites into the movement. And they brought 1,000 white people from the north to come to their training camp in Ohio. And they trained them in this nonviolent way to how to go out to the black community and try to get them to vote. This was called Freedom Summer Volunteers. Well, sure enough, they went into Mississippi, and sure enough, they got into a lot of trouble. Many of them were seriously injured, and ultimately it ended up with 3 people being killed, 1 black kid and 2 white kids, but not only killed, but seriously mutilated. Now, those 1,000 white kids started, they were in colleges, and they went back to their colleges and started demonstrating. And the reason they started demonstrating was that the colleges were still very much in the 50s. The colleges were still like the parents saying, you can do this, but you cannot do this. You have to act right, you have to take these classes. In fact, I remember in 1960, the president of the University of California, Berkeley, said, the university will do for this half of the century what the automobile did for the last half. And Berkeley was the first place with demonstrations, actually. And why did the kids demonstrate? Well, the kids demonstrated, number one, because they were being treated like kids. They were being, you know, there were curfews, there were dress codes. It was all very, very serious. Let's see if I have that. I didn't think I was going to say it. Yeah, I looked up in my old 1870 dictionary the word lecture. I hate the word lecture. I don't try to use it. Anyway, I looked it up in my old Webster's dictionary, and it said a lecture is a formal reproof. So I looked up reproof, and it says to censure to the face. And then I looked up censure, and it said to blame. It's an interesting definition of a lecture, isn't it? To blame you to your face. And the other thing that really upset the college kids at that time was that they didn't consider their education terribly relevant. There were no black teachers, there were no courses on social issues, there were contemporary. All the courses tended to be, you know, very conservative and about the kind of formal education that we thought of in the 50s. So it started basically in nonviolent ways. The first thing I think that happened was at Berkeley, as I recall, where the students simply had a sit-in at the administration building, and the police had to come and drag them out. But by 1968, the whole thing had gone completely amok. In 1964, it really started. And by 1968, because of both the civil rights movement and the Vietnamese War, about 50% of the Americans were very, very fed up. And it was really very split. It's amazing. They took surveys of how many people believed in the war, and it was almost exactly 50% believed in it, and almost 50% didn't. The people who believed in it had a certain motto, America, love it or leave it. The people who didn't believe in it said, hey, this is our country and we can change it. Consequently, it started getting rather violent at that stage. And I think it reached its first peak of intensity on April 4th, after that, when Martin Luther King was killed. When Martin Luther King was killed, there were 126 different riots across the country. 21,000 people were put in prison. 21,000. And 146 people were killed in that week. If you were here at Harvard then, you would have been possibly one of the people who demonstrated on Mass Avenue on your way to Brattle Street. You would have encountered, after a small time, a block of policemen with tear gas that shot tear gas into the crowd and then charged at them and beat lots of people quite seriously. Imagine that was not that long ago. Imagine just walking down Mass Ave saying that I'm mad at the world and I want this war to stop, and you meet this kind of resistance. But the resistance was more than just this kind of resistance. It was really a civil war, because the police represented in many ways to society the blue-collar worker, the sort of middle America, the America love it or leave it, and the kids were the ones saying, this is my country too and I want to change it. And so it was more than a police action, it was a real class struggle. It obviously got worse and worse, and by 1970, this was the extreme of it, I think, as far as I can tell, which is when, I think it was April 30th, that Nixon decided to invade Cambodia. And at that stage, the word credibility gap took on real meaning, because in the 50s, you sort of had control of media. But by this stage, and because so much of the culture was rebelling, the news media was showing you on TV what was really happening. You couldn't be lied to anymore. And when Nixon invaded Cambodia, this was the last straw. And this last straw led to a lot of consequences. One consequence was that 80% of the colleges in the United States, that's 80%, that's a lot, went on strike. And we're talking about going on strike right around the beginning of May with finals and papers. It completely messed up the educational system. They didn't know what to do. They had to cancel all the finals at 80% of the colleges. They didn't know what to do about papers. And basically, that whole term just went amok. At that stage, the number of riots were unbelievable around the country, and the movement was taking on a new turn, which I'll talk about in a few classes later on, and starting to take on the aspect much more of a war than of a revolution. And actually, there were movements that assassinated people, and we'll talk about people like the Weathermen and the Black Panthers later on. So this tremendous social change that happened in the 60s obviously was going to be reflected in the art of the 60s. That's why I spent so much time talking about the environment that the composer was in the 60s. Because whereas the 50s were a true cultural revolution, and art was questioning the very sensibility of art was about, the 60s were a social revolution and political revolution, which is different than a cultural revolution. And in the 60s, there was no chance anymore for the artist to not take a stance. It was black and white. You're either on one side or you're on the other side. And there was no way your music could maintain a kind of explicit neutrality anymore. So what was the young artist like in the 60s that grew up? Well, one of the things you grow up with was this overwhelming desire to get rid of the prejudice in society, because it was so blatant at that stage, the levels of prejudice. And as you know, people of your age are relatively impatient, and prejudice isn't going to go away overnight, but on another level, do everything possible to get rid of it then. So the artist was faced with then the notion of, how do you get rid of prejudice? Well, the main way you get rid of prejudice was the word we used a lot in the 60s, openness. If you're open to things and what they are, then you can accept them for their value. Now, if you're open to things, what excludes being open? Well, essentially what excludes being open is the limitation that expectation puts on you. If you expect something to be a certain way, you're back in the dialectic. You're choosing between one or the other, therefore you're not really open. So the young artist is faced with somehow of making an art that is non-dialectical, an art that doesn't choose between things, an art of singularity. So if you could limit a piece to a single image or a single event that wasn't about any kind of duality, you were out of the domain of dialecticism. This, of course, comes from the philosophy of Cage a lot, and the philosophy of Cage was extremely influential on the young artists in the early 60s. The main difference, though, from the Cage philosophy, as I said just a second ago, and the 60s, is that the 60s had to confront social issues. The 50s implicitly did with works like Cage, but Cage was really confronting artistic issues. The 60s were really confronting social issues. The relation of the 60s to the 50s largely is, the 60s is very closely related in many ways to Dada and Surrealism and those kinds of movements that really question the very meaning of social values. And what's going to happen is it's going to get very, very confused who's doing what and what art form is what. Is this really music? Is this performance art? People didn't know what to call it. And many of the people in those days who called themselves composers really had no musical training and never wrote pieces that had anything to do with music. I've been wondering the last few days why so many of the artists of that period called themselves composers rather than something else, like an artist. And I think it had to do with the fact that composition was the most neutral. No one really knew what it meant in a certain way, especially after the Cage Revolution. So many people called themselves composers, and many of the kinds of events you're going to listen to on your little Fluxus tape and the articles that you're going to read are by people that were actually not musically trained but called themselves composers. I think what was happening at this stage was that America now was, with respect to culture, and with respect to post-World War II, a teenager. And the artists of the 60s, in a certain way, were like teenagers questioning the very core of the values that they had been trained. You know how yourself, at a certain age, you sort of wonder why your parents always said you couldn't do this, so you have to try doing that once. You have to try, you know, there's this kind of pushing the limit. See how far, when someone says this is a limit and don't go beyond it, there's a tendency at a certain age to say, hey, what's this limit about? Why am I being pushed back by this limit constantly? What happens if I go beyond it? And this is what the 60s were going to do. And this is why the art of the 60s is very extreme, and a lot of it isn't very pleasant in some ways, nor was it meant to be pleasant. The main movement, well, one of the main movements, probably the focal movement of the whole thing, was a movement called Fluxus. The title was given by a guy by the name of George McCunis in 1961. McCunis was a writer. And he gave the definition to Fluxus. He said, Fluxus events strive for a non-structural and non-theatrical qualities of the simple natural event, a game or a gag. It is the fusion of Spike Jones, vaudeville, gag, children's games, and Duchamp. Well, we're going to see more and more. As I said, it got confusing what the categories were in the early 60s, and one of the categories that got a little confused also was what was pop culture and what was classical culture. And the first place where Fluxus art was done was at a loft that Yoko Ono owned. Now, Yoko Ono, as I'm sure you know, later married John Lennon. But actually, she goes way back. When she was in Japan, she was married to a composer by the name of Ichinagi, who was actually a student of Cage at one stage. And Cage went to Japan several times and toured with Yoko Ono, and she did performance pieces of Cage. And still, at several concerts I've done at Cage, she shows up. They're very good friends. And she also helps support his projects. So Yoko Ono had a good friend by the name of Lamont Young, who we've talked about before. And she and Lamont started, well, there were three places at the same time, but this is one of the focal points. They started at her loft on Chambers Street a series of performances every week. And Lamont would organize them, and she would help put them on. Well, when we talk about people's relevant history, Lamont Young is a very interesting character. He was born in 1935 in Bern, Iowa, and grew up for a few years in a log cabin. In fact, the earliest recollection he has, he likes very long sounds. I explained that to you before, but we'll get back to that later. The earliest recollection he has, before anything else he can remember, is lying in his crib for hours listening to the wind blow through the cracks of his log cabin. Later, not too much later, they moved to Utah. He was from a Mormon family, Young, you know, Lamont. And his father was a sheep herder. And his earliest memories after the wind, since he didn't live in a log cabin at that stage, was he used to like to go sit under the power lines and listen to them for hours and hours and hours. And later in his music, he uses this chord extensively. That chord is his recollection of what the power line sounded like. There was a factory down the road that had these huge engines, and when he was like 2 and 3 years old, he would just go sit in front of the engines for hours and hours and hours. His earliest musical training was learning cowboy music. His parents were hillbillies, and his mother and Aunt Norma taught him cowboy songs when he was about 4 years old. He really liked the ones that didn't change much, you know, that just sort of did the same things over and over. And he got quite good at it, and then Aunt Norma taught him how to tap dance, and he was able to tap dance and sing cowboy songs at the same time. When he was 7, they moved to where his uncle was, and his uncle played jazz saxophone, and so did his father a little bit, but they didn't have one. So his uncle gave him a soprano saxophone, which is a little like a clarinet, high saxophone, and that's when he started learning jazz. And his father taught him jazz by, whenever he would play a wrong note, he just hit him with a stick. And he got to be an extremely accomplished jazz artist. He played with some of the most famous jazz people in the 50s, and like Don Cherry, etc., and had very much the possibility, if he wanted to become a jazz musician. He was quite successful at it. But he felt that jazz was too limited. Oddly enough, he said, quote, I felt like I had to conform all the time when I was playing jazz. And he said, in classical music, he really felt that there was the possibility of much more freedom. So when he was in high school, he moved to the L.A. public school system, and that was the first time he was educated in other musics. And he just went to it, like, madly. And he started getting very interested in serial music, and he actually studied with one of Schoenberg's main students for several years. And he wrote serial music. The serial music he wrote was quite slow, as you might expect, and there weren't too many notes, but it still was serially organized and quite complex, more or less in the style of Webern. So then he went off to Germany to work with a composer there who I mentioned before by the name of Stockhausen. And Stockhausen in those days was sort of the guru of serial music in Europe. And at that stage, John Cage came and gave a lecture in 1959 at Darmstadt, where Lamont Young was. And from then on, his life was really very, very different, as you might expect. He went back to New York, and that's basically 2 years later is when this whole Fluxus movement starts. Now, this Fluxus movement also, there were three centers for it. One was a cafe owned by an artist by the name of Larry Poons. And Larry Poons, I mentioned before, remember when I was talking about the golden mean, and I said in the 50s and 60s there were some artists that played with this, and there was this one artist who just put a bright dot right in the center of the canvas, and when you look at it, you keep trying to move it visually because it's not right in the right place? Well, Larry Poons was that artist. And he had a cafe, and then there was a gallery called AG Gallery, which was a gallery uptown New York that also presented a lot of Fluxus activities, and these were going on quite a bit at the time. What Lamont called it at that stage was the theater of the singular event. Well, in this whole thing again, oh, let me read you another just quick little quote of Lamont because it'll relate to what I'm going to say now. I strongly admit I didn't come out of a vacuum. I deeply appreciate people like Cage. Now, Lamont's music is interesting because it's reflecting something that's happening in society in general. And that's that he's starting to take on all sorts of different influences that are non-Western. And the 60s are extremely receptive to non-Western influences. That's like when the Maharishi came to this country. That's when everyone started having gurus. That's when lots of people went to India to study. That's when Zen became extremely popular at that stage in this country. And people were looking for alternatives outside of Western reasoning. And Lamont studied many, many kinds of music. One of his favorite was, what's it called, Temyar Dream Music from Malaysia. And Temyar Dream Music from Malaysia uses a three-note chord that's almost exactly like his dream chord that came from the power lines. So he was, of course, attracted to that. He studied Indian music very, very, very seriously, North Indian classical music, for about ever since the 60s, and he still does. And he studied with some of the greatest teachers there are in that tradition. He was also extremely attracted to the notion of gagaku, which is a kind of theatrical Japanese music, which he studied also with a great deal of care. Also, for several years, he collaborated on projects with American Indian musicians and played a lot of American Indian music. So, although he studied Western classical music seriously and for a long time, and came out of that tradition, you can see how the world now is starting to dominate and how, in a certain way, only someone in America with the kind of openness of someone who was born in a log cabin could be receptive to this huge body of different kind of music that he was going to get into. Well, the Cage influence, as I'm getting back to that, was a very, very direct one, actually. You remember the theater piece, from, I'm sure you all do, and I talked about the origins of that in 1952 when he did the Black Mountain event. Well, he goes back to New York in 1956, Cage does, and at the School of New Social Research in New York, he teaches a class that's going to explore basically new kinds of theatrical art and music. And in this class are going to be almost, not almost all, but many, many, many of the key people that are going to create this Fluxus movement and some of the other movements that are going to come out of it. For example, Larry Poons was in that class. Many of the people who are in your assignments this week, like Jackson McClough, the poet, and George Brecht, the performance artist. George Brecht, by the way, was actually a chemist. Dick Higgins, who later became a very important publisher and also performance artist, was in the class. And the names go on and on and on and on. Pardon me. One of the people in the class was Alan Kaprow. And Alan Kaprow started a new kind of art form officially in 1959 when he coined the term happening. That was his idea to call it happenings. And happenings were, again, non-dialectical, single-image kinds of things, very compartmentalized, where nothing quite added up in any kind of narrative way. Let's see some of his quotes. Happenings were environments where spatial representations of a multi-leveled attitude towards painting. The actions will mean nothing clearly formulable as far as the artist is concerned. Happenings was a meaningless term to indicate something spontaneous, something that just happens to happen. Now, the happening movement really came out of the art world more than anything else. And it came in a period that we started later calling post-studio art. And for a while, especially in the early 60s, the idea of painting on a canvas was very unfashionable in the art world. And so this idea of happenings, or these kind of images, where people would perform a kind of singular event, as Lamont called it, was really catching on a lot. And for example, one of the pieces Capro did as a solo was he would come out and there would be a table and he would have 10 cognac glasses. And he would fill the first one with cognac. And then he would gradually pour it from one glass to the next until it all evaporated. The piece usually took about 14 hours. You could come or go. There was, you know, sometimes he just did it in the hall. I happened to teach at a school where he was at the time, and sometimes you'd just walk in and he'd be there in the gallery pouring cognac. You could sit and watch him if you wanted, didn't matter. In the magazine where we gave you all of your reprints, there's a what's called a sand activity, which he did with students there at the time, where they went down to the beach and bagged sand, and then they put those in suitcases and sent those to friends that they knew where there was also sand available, and they would take that sand and empty it out, and then they would fill it with the sand from their environment, put it back in the suitcase, and send it back UPS to them, and that they would take the suitcases and take them back to where they got the original sand and replace the original sand with a new sand. Claes Oldenburg did this wonderful happening in 1961 called Injun. I've only read about it. It happened in Texas. You went way out in the country to this farmhouse, and it was pouring rain, and you went into this farmhouse, and you were let in. And each room, you just sort of peeked in like a voyeur, and each room had an amazing kind of just incredible image. The first room was just covered with paper and plaster, and you could see that there was this person sort of in the middle of it, and you just saw like their hand and their nose coming out of it. And it was all timed. You could only look at each room for a certain amount of time. And each, again, it was a singular kind of image. They didn't add up into a story. As you walked through the whole thing, it didn't make sense like a play or anything. You just saw image after image after image. So this notion of happening in art was sort of the art movement's direct reply to Fluxus. But Fluxus itself was much more confrontational. Fluxus itself really was out to destroy art. Where people accuse Cage of destroying art, perhaps implicitly he's suggesting that art can transform into a whole new thing. But George Mikunis is going to say very overtly that art should be over in one of his Fluxus manifestos. Fluxus' objectives are social, not aesthetic, and concerned with the gradual elimination of fine arts. This is motivated by the desire to stop the waste of material and human resources and to divert it socially to constructive ends. The flux is definitely against the art object as non-functional commodity to be sold and make a livelihood for the artist. It could temporarily have the pedagogical function of teaching people the needlessness of art, including the eventual needlessness of itself. It should not, therefore, be permanent. The primary contribution of a truly concrete artist consists in creating a concept or method by which form can be created independently of him. The furthest step towards concretism of this kind is, of course, art nihilism. This concept opposes and rejects art itself, since the very meaning of it implies artificiality, whether in creation of form or method. To approach closer affinity with concrete reality and its closer understanding, the art nihilist or anti-artist either creates anti-art or exercises nothingness. The anti-art forms are directed primarily against art as a profession, against the artificial separation of the performer from the audience, or creator or spectator, or life and art. It is against the artificial forms or patterns or methods of art itself. It is against the purposefulness, formfulness, and meaning of all art. Anti-art is life, is nature, is true reality, is one and all. Rainfall is anti-art. A babble of a crowd is anti-art. A sneeze is anti-art. A flight of a butterfly is anti-art, or movements of microbes are anti-art. They are as beautiful and as worthwhile to be aware of as art itself. If man could experience the world, the concrete world surrounding him, in the same way he experiences art, there would be no need for art, artists, and similar non-productive elements. And as you can see from this statement, it's a manifesto against art. It's declaring art has to be over because art has not been for the people. So pretty much what's going to happen in this whole movement is the artists are going to severely question the very premises of what art is about, not from the point of view of Cage, of looking at the premises of art, but questioning of how art relates to society. And they're going to confront it on many, many levels. One of the first confrontations that becomes real obvious is they're going to confront you, the audience. They're going to confront the role of the passive listener or observer. Some of Lamont's pieces from 1960, composition 1960, number 3. The audience, someone comes out and tells them, he chooses a certain amount of time and tells them that whatever they want to do during that amount of time is the piece. And then he leaves. Then at the end of the time, comes back on, says the piece is over. Another piece he did was someone comes out, and they don't have to announce this one, but they usually did, and announced that the lights are going to be turned off, and when the lights are turned back on, the piece will be over. So you come into the hall, you know, you pay your $18 for the concert, someone comes in and turns out the lights, 5 minutes later they turn it back on, and that's the composition. There's another composition of Lamont's where a butterfly is released in the room. That's the piece. Now, if you want the piece to go on a really long time, you open the door, and when the butterfly decides to leave, the piece is over. If you are limited in the amount of time you can have with the butterfly, then you're allowed to catch it as long as you're careful and release it at the end of the piece. Another one that Lamont did was he would come out with several performers, and they would turn out the lights on the stage, turn on the hall lights, and all the performers would watch the audience. Just sit there and watch the audience, usually, sometimes for very long periods of time. There was a theater company in those days called the Living Theater, amazing group, just an amazing group, started in the early 60s, Julian Beck and Judith Malina. They were, for the most, I'm not sure exactly why, I think they got them on tax evasion or something, but for the most part of their career, they performed only in Europe and weren't allowed back in the United States. But they came back for one last tour, which I saw in, it must have been about 1968, maybe 67, or as late as 69, right in that period. Before I forget, because it's pretty funny, Julian Beck died, but Judith Malina, who's a phenomenal actress who started this company, who's married to Julian Beck, I hadn't heard of in years, and then the other day I saw an ad for the new movie, The Addams Family, that they made, and she plays the grandmother in that. So if you see The Addams Family, that's Judith Malina. Well, they also questioned the audience in very, very, very severe ways. One of the less severe ways was sort of like what Lamont was doing. They would come out at the end occasionally of performances, turn the lights on the audience, turn the lights out on the stage, and they would applaud instead of the audience. But they did this other thing I'll never forget in New Haven in 19, whatever that was, called Paradise Now. And Paradise Now, they did a lot of different kinds of things. Some of their plays were quite constructed. They did this thing called Frankenstein, where it was basically completely written out and very visually amazing and all sorts of acrobatics and things. And then they did some more improvisational kinds of plays where they had theater games. But this was an audience one, a Paradise Now. And they were often out in the audience talking to the audience. Gradually, over the course of the evening, they got more and more of the people from the audience on the stage. And they started participating in different theater games where someone would do an action, you would respond to that action in a certain way. And this went on for a while. Then gradually through the course of the evening, and remember this is the 60s, through the course of the evening, more and more people were removing their clothes. And the play ended with about 100 people running down the streets of New Haven, completely naked and screaming. And that was, the whole play was constructed to do that. They spent 3 hours very carefully deconditioning the audience, if you will, and bringing them into this whole new kind of reality. And they were so strong theatrically, and the world was so crazy at that stage anyway, that they were able to do this. Of course, hundreds of people were arrested. And when people found out about it, because they opened in New Haven, most of the other cities canceled that particular production that they were going to do. That was pretty much the end of the Living Theater at that stage. And because, as we will talk about in a few classes, around the early 70s, this kind of notion of art really starts dissipating, and it starts dissipating very strongly, and it's really more or less completely over by about 1975, and really over 1971, 72. Another artist who was really questioning the entire sensibility of the audience at that stage was Andy Warhol. Andy Warhol was originally a commercial artist and a very good one. He's from a small town in Pennsylvania. And he did shoe art. And he had won several awards. He could really draw very good shoes. Well, in 1961, he blew the mind of the art community apart when he started painting Dick Tracy and Popeye. Because for the first time now, what you saw in your newspaper, you could buy for your wall. And Warhol became the great iconographer of America. He made America look at its own icons. We'll come to that in a second. But he started really questioning the whole notion of fine art. One of the ways he really questioned the notion of fine art is that he reproduced things by silk screening. It's a very easy process. Anyone can do it. It no longer took the brush on a canvas. All you needed was this silk screen press. He often didn't even sign his paintings. He liked the way his mother wrote his signature much better than the way he wrote his signature. So he had his mother sign Andy Warhol on some of his paintings. I remember in the 60s he appeared on talk shows fairly often on TV. And then it was discovered that Andy Warhol wasn't the one on talk shows. He had hired a double who looked like him to appear for him on talk shows. So they finally got him on the Johnny Carson show, and when he appeared on the Johnny Carson show, he refused to say a word. He just stared at Johnny Carson the whole time. So as I say, he was the one who sort of made America look at its icons. This wasn't unusual. I mean, in medieval art, the Crusades, Christ, the Virgin Mary, things like that were the icons of the time. Now he's saying, look, America, what are your icons? Well, one of the icons he thought that America loved was death and destruction, since you saw it on the newspaper every day. So he did a whole series of death and destruction silkscreens. He loved automobile accidents where people were dying in the streets, and he would make these beautiful silkscreens with maybe 40 representations of this accident all in different colors. He did the John Kennedy assassination with silkscreens, the same thing. There was a whole exhibit, a whole room filled with different pictures of the Kennedy assassination. He liked pictures of the atomic bomb. He was very into that, from Hiroshima. He also had a very nice series of silk screens of the electric chair. And again, he took these things from the newspaper, essentially, and showed America what it really cared about. He did Campbell's soup can. He did Brillo. It was a great case in American Supreme Court history when Campbell's soup took him to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court declared that that was art. I'm not sure it would these days. It would be very interesting if that decision were different, wouldn't it? If Andy Warhol said, no, Brillo, you can't do that. There was an older woman who took this course last year, I'll never forget, who lived in New York, around the corner from Andy Warhol. And she said the sort of high point of her entire life is she walked into the market one day, and there was Andy Warhol holding a can of Campbell's soup. She said that was sort of the main moment of her life. So another thing he started doing was movies. And one of the icons of America was the concept of being a superstar. So he took this icon of the superstar and put it in his movies. Let's talk about later movies now. And they would make a movie. Sometimes he would tell them what to do. Sometimes he wouldn't tell them what to do. He used to make a movie every week. And then he stopped making the movies. He had a friend of his by the name of Paul Morrissey making the movies. And Paul Morrissey, but they were always signed Andy Warhol, even though he had absolutely nothing to do with them. And the movies were really extreme. I mean, really extreme, some of them. Like, there's this scene in Chelsea Girls where a guy by the name of On Dean dresses up like the Pope and on camera shoots up with heroin. He's a transvestite also, shoots up with heroin and then pretends he's the Pope for the next 10 minutes. And if you want to see 10 minutes of total insanity in a film, And again, what does this do to the audience? The audience comes into a movie theater. They pay their, I saw it in New York, in a regular movie theater. You walk in, you pay your money, and you're seeing some guy dragged off of the street who can barely stand up pretending he's the Pope for the next 10 minutes of the movie. The first part of the movie starts with two screens at the same time, and Nico, who we'll talk about later, is just there brushing her hair for about almost a half hour. She had beautiful hair, very beautiful hair. And what was interesting with Warhol also was he made himself into an icon. The first thing I was talking about with Johnny Carson became more and more the case. No one really knew what Andy Warhol was. There was always this kind of strange mystique around him. He never answered questions in any kind of normal way. He never seemed to really talk to anyone, although he would converse with people. And so he made himself into an icon. He made the artist itself an icon, and he became the representation of it. Of course, there's, you know, we talked about Alfred Jarre with Ubu Wa. You can see that happening then. There were other composers like Eric Satie in France that did similar things in the 20s. But Warhol took this to a huge extreme. And Warhol's change of American culture by taking America's own images and saying, here, America, look at them, and this is fine art, really transformed what art was about. Next time we'll go on to some of the other ways that these artists were questioning things with danger, violence, etc. And then we'll end up hopefully next Monday with a slightly more optimistic approach to the whole thing. So we do have classes Friday, okay?